This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Escape, theft, and murder, part of a record of casually committed horrible crimes. Not surprisingly, Jack found the man's account of his life fascinating. And even though Jack was suffering greatly from several physical ailments, he was excited enough to frame a short story around the cook's exploits. Inspired by the cook's story, Jack began to write Maquis on October 5th, 18 days after their first interview. So, let's refill our tiki mugs with a few more Mai Tais and listen to tonight's story, Maquis by Jack London. He weighed 110 pounds. His hair was kinky and negroid, and he was black. He was peculiarly black. He was neither blue-black nor purple-black, but plum-black. His name was Maquis, and he was the son of a chief. He had three tambos. Tambo is Melanesian for taboo, and his first cousin to that Polynesian word. Maquis' three tambos were as follows. First, he must never shake hands with a woman, nor have a woman's hand touch him or any of his personal belongings. Second, he must never eat clams nor any food from a fire in which clams had been cooked. Thirdly, he must never touch a crocodile, nor travel in a canoe that carried any part of a crocodile, even if it was as large as a tooth. Of a different black were his teeth, which were deep black, or perhaps lamp black. They had been made so in a single night by his mother, who had compressed about them a powdered mineral which was dug from the landslide back of Port Adams. Port Adams is a saltwater village of Malaleta, and Malaleta is the most savage island in the Solomons. So savage that no traders nor planters have yet gained a foothold on it. While from the time of the earliest Bechemer fishers and sandalwood traders down to the latest labor recruiters equipped with automatic rifles and gasoline engines, scores of white adventurers have been passed out by tomahawks and soft-nosed Snyder bullets. So Malaita remains today, in the 20th century, the stamping ground of the labor recruiters who farm its coasts for laborers who engage and contract themselves to toil on the plantations of the neighboring and more civilized islands for a wage of $30 a year. The natives of those neighboring and more civilized islands have themselves become too civilized to work on plantations. Maquis' ears were pierced, not in one place nor two places, but in a couple of dozen places. In one of the smaller holes, he carries a clay pipe. The larger holes were too large for such use. The bowl of the pipe would have passed through. In fact, in the largest hole in each ear, he habitually wore round wooden plugs that were an even 4 inches in diameter. Roughly speaking, the circumference of said holes was 12 1/2 inches. Maquis was Catholic in his taste. In the various smaller holes, he carried such things as an empty rifle cartridge, horseshoe nails, copper screws, pieces of string, braids of sennet, strips of green leaf, and in the cool of the day, scarlet hibiscus flowers, from which it will be seen that pockets were not necessary to his well-being. Besides, pockets were impossible, for his only wearing apparel consisted of a piece of calico several inches wide, a pocket knife he wore in his hair, the blade snapped down on a kinky lock. His most prized possession was the handle of a china cup, which he suspended from a ring of turtle shell, which in turn was passed through the partition cartilage of his nose. But in spite of embellishments, Maquis had a nice face. It was really a pretty face, viewed by any standard, and for a Melanesian, it was a remarkably a good-looking face. Its one fault was its lack of strength. It was softly effeminate, almost girlish. The features were small, regular, and delicate. The chin was weak, and the mouth was weak. There was no strength or character in the jaws, forehead, and nose, and the eyes only could be caught any hint of the unknown quantities that were so large a part of his makeup and that other persons could not understand. These unknown qualities were pluck, pertinacity, fearlessness, imagination, and cunning. And when they found expression in some consistent and striking action, those about him were astonished. Maquis' father was chief over the village of Port Adams, and thus by birth a saltwater man. Maquis was half amphibian. He knew the way of the fishes and oysters, and the reef was an open book to him. Canoes also he knew. He learned to swim when he was a year old. At 7 years, he could hold his breath the full minute and swim straight down to the bottom through 30 feet of water. And at 7 years, he was stolen by the bushmen, who cannot even swim and who are afraid of the salt water. Thereafter, Maquis saw the ocean only from a distance, through rifts in the jungle and from open spaces on the high mountain sides. He became the slave of old Benfala, head chief of a score of scattered bush villages on the range lips of Malalita, the smoke of which on calm mornings is about the only evidence the seafaring white men have of the teeming interior population. For the whites do not penetrate Malalita. They tried it once in the days when the search was on for gold, but they always left their heads behind to grin from the smoky rafters of the bushmen's huts. When Maquis was a young man of 17, Benfoa got out of tobacco. He got dreadfully out of tobacco. It was hard times in all his villages. He'd been guilty of a mistake. Suo was a harbor, so small that a large schooner could not swing at anchor in it. It was surrounded by mangroves that overhung the deep water. It was a trap, and into the trap sailed two white men in a small ketch. They were after recruits, and they possessed much tobacco and trade goods, to say nothing of three rifles and plenty of ammunition. Now, there were no saltwater men living in Suo, and it was there that the bushmen came down to the sea to sign on with the recruiting vessels. The ketch did a terrific traffic. It signed on 20 recruits the first day. Even old Fenfoa signed on. And that same day, the score of new recruits chopped off the two white men's heads, killed the boat's crew, and burned the ketch. Thereafter, and for 3 months, there was tobacco and trade goods in plenty and despair in all of bush villages. Then came the man of war that threw shells for miles into the hills, frightening the people out of their villages and into the deeper brush. Next, the man of war sent landing parties ashore. The villages were all burned, along with the tobacco and trade stuff. The coconuts and bananas were chopped down, the taro gardens uprooted, and the pigs and chickens killed. It taught Fenfoa a lesson, but in the meantime, he was out of tobacco. Also, his young men were too frightened to sign on with the recruiting vessels. That was why Fenfoa ordered his slave, Maquis, to be carried down and signed on for a half a case of tobacco advance, along with knives, axes, calicoes, and beads, which he would pay for with his toil on the plantations. Maquis was sorely frightened when they brought him on board the schooner. He was a lamb led to the slaughter. White men were ferocious creatures. They had to be, or else they would not make a practice of venturing along the Malalita coast and into all harbors. Two on a schooner, and each schooner carried about 15 to 20 blacks as boat's crew, and often as high as 60 or 70 black recruits. In addition to this, there was always the danger of the shore population, the sudden attack and the cutting off of the schooner and all hands. Truly, white men must be terrible. Besides, they were possessed of such devils, rifles that shot very rapidly many times, things of iron and brass that made the schooners go when there was no wind, and boxes that talked and laughed, just as men talked and laughed. Aye, and he had heard of one white man whose particular devil was so powerful that he could take out all his teeth and put them back at will. Down into the cabin they took Maquis. On deck, one white man kept guard with two revolvers in his belt. In the cabin, the other white man sat with a book before him, in which he inscribed strange marks and lines. He looked at Maquis as though he had been a pig or a fowl, glanced under the hollows of his arms, and wrote in the book. Then he held out the writing stick, and Maquis just barely touched it with his hand, in so doing pledging himself to toil for 3 years on the plantations of the Moon Gleam Soap Company. It was not explained to him that the will of the ferocious white men would be used to enforce the pledge, and that, behind all, for the same use, was all the power and all the warships of Great Britain. Other blacks there were on board, from unheard-of far places, and when the white men spoke to them, they tore the long feather from Maquis' hair, cut that same hair short, and wrapped around his waist a lava of bright yellow calico. After many days on the schooner, and after beholding more land and islands than he had ever dreamed of, he was landed on New Georgia and put to work in the field, clearing jungle and cutting cane grass. For the first time he knew what work was. Even as a slave to Fenfoa, he had not worked like this. And he did not like work. He was up at dawn and in at dark, on two meals a day, and the food was tiresome. For weeks at a time, they were given nothing but sweet potatoes to eat. And for weeks at a time, it would be nothing but rice. He could cut out the coconut from the shells day after day, but for long days and weeks, he fed the fires that smoked the copra till his eyes got sore and he was set to falling trees. He was a good axe man, and later he was put in the bridge-building gang. At times, he served as boat's crew in the whale boats when they brought in copra from distant beaches or when the white man went out to dynamite fish. Among other things, he learned the Bêche de Mer English, which he could talk with all white men and all other recruits who otherwise would have talked in 1,000 different dialects. Also, he learned certain things about the white men, principally that they kept their word. If they told a boy he was going to receive a stick of tobacco, he got it. If they told a boy they would knock 7 bells out of him if he did a certain thing, when he did that thing, 7 bells invariably were knocked out of him. Maquis did not know what 7 bells were, but they occurred in Bêche de Mer, and he imagined them to be the blood and teeth that sometimes accompanied the process of knocking out 7 bells. One other thing he learned, no boy was struck or punished unless he did wrong. Even when the white men were drunk, as they were frequently, they never struck unless a rule had been broken. Maquis did not like the plantation. He hated work, and he was the son of a chief. Furthermore, it was 10 years since he had been stolen from Port Adams by Fenfoa, and he was homesick. He was even homesick for the slavery under Fenfoa. So he ran away. He struck back into the bush, and the idea of working southward to the beach and stealing a canoe in which to go home to Port Adams. But the fever got him, and he was captured and brought back more dead than alive. A second time he ran away, in the company of 2 Malaleita boys. They got down the coast 20 miles and were hidden in the hut of a Malaleita freeman who dwelt in that village. But in the dead of night, 2 white men came who were not afraid of all the village people and who knocked 7 bells out of the 3 runaways, tied them like pigs and tossed them into the whale boat. But the man in whose house they had hidden, 7 times 7 bells must have been knocked out of him from the way the hair, skin, and teeth flew. And he was discouraged for the rest of his natural life from harboring runaway laborers. For a year, Maquis toiled on. Then he was made a houseboy and had good food and easy times, with light work and keeping the house clean and serving the white men with whiskey and beer at all hours of the day and most hours of the night. He liked it, but he liked Port Adams more. He had 2 years longer to serve, but 2 years were too long for him in the throes of homesickness. He had grown wiser with his year of service, and being now a houseboy, he had opportunity. He had the cleaning of the rifles, and he knew where the key of the storeroom was hung. He planned the escape, and one night, 10 Malalite boys and one boy from San Cristobal snuck from the barracks and dragged one of the whaleboats down to the beach. It was Maki who supplied the key that opened the padlock on the boat, and it was Maki who equipped the boat with a dozen Winchesters, an immense amount of ammunition, a case of dynamite with detonators and fuse, and 10 cases of tobacco. The northwest monsoon was blowing, and they fled south in the nighttime, hiding by day on detached and uninhabited inlets, or dragged their whaleboat into the brush on large islands. Thus they gained Guadalcanar, skirted halfway along it, and across the indispensable straits to Florida Island. And it was here that they killed the San Cristobal boy, saving his head and cooking and eating the rest of him. The Malaleta coast was only 20 miles away, but the last night a strong current and baffling winds prevented them from gaining across. Daylight found them still several miles from their goal, but daylight brought a cutter in which were two white men who were not afraid of 11 Malaleta men armed with 12 rifles. Maki and his companions were carried back to Tulagi, where lived the great white master of all the white men. And the great white master held a court, after which one by one the runaways were tied up and given 20 lashes each and sentenced to a fine of $15. Then they were sent back to New Georgia, where the white men knocked 7 bells out of them all around and put them to work. But Maki was no longer houseboy. He was put in the road-making gang. A fine of $15 had been paid by the white men from whom he had run away, and he was told that he would have to work it out, which meant 6 months additional toil. Further, his share of the stolen tobacco earned him another year of toil. Fort Adams was now 3 years and a half away. So he stole a canoe one night, hit on the inlets in Manning Strait, passed through the straits, and began working along the eastern coast of Yzabel, only to be captured 2/3 of the way along by the white men on Marenghi Lagoon. After a week, he escaped from them and took to the bush. There were no bush natives on Yzabel, only saltwater men who were all Christians. The white men put up a reward of 500 sticks of tobacco, and every time Maki ventured down to the sea to steal a canoe, he was chased by the saltwater men. 4 months of this passed when the reward, having been raised to 1,000 sticks, he was caught and sent back to New Georgia and the road-building gang. Now 1,000 sticks are worth $50, and Maki had to pay the reward himself, which required a year and 8 months' labor. So Port Adams was now 5 years away. Maki's homesickness was greater than ever, and it did not appeal to him to settle down and be good, work out his 4 years, and go home. The next time, he was caught in the very act of running away. His case was brought before Mr. Havby, the island manager of the Moon Gleam Soap Company, who adjudged him and incorrigible. The company had plantations on the Santa Cruz Islands, hundreds of miles across the sea, and there it sent Solomon Islands incorrigibles. And there Maki was sent. Though he never arrived, the schooner stopped at Santa Ana, and in the night Maki swam ashore, where he stole 2 rifles and a case of tobacco from the trader and got away in a canoe to Cristobal. Malaita was now to the north, 50 or 60 miles away. But when he attempted the passage, he was caught by a light gale and driven back to Santa Ana, where the trader clapped him in irons and held him against the return of the schooner from Santa Cruz. The 2 rifles the trader recovered, but the case of tobacco was charged up to Maki at the rate of another year. The sum of years he now owed the company was 6. On the way back to New Georgia, the schooner dropped anchor in Maru Sound, which lies at the southeastern extremity of Guadalcanar. Maki swam ashore with handcuffs on his wrists and got away to the brush. The schooner went on, but the moon-gleamed trader ashore offered 1,000 sticks, and to him Maki was brought by the bushmen with 1 year and 8 months tacked on to his account. Again, and before the schooner called in, he got away, this time in a whale boat, accompanied by a case of the trader's tobacco. But a northwest gale wrecked him upon Ugi, where the Christian natives stole his tobacco and turned him over to the moon-gleamed trader who resided there. The tobacco the natives stole meant another year for him, and the tale was now 8 years and a half. "We'll send him to Lord Howe," said Have-Be. "Funster's there, and we'll let them settle it between them. It'll be a case, I imagine, of Maki getting Benster, or Bunster getting Maki. And good riddance in either event." If one leaves Marenge Lagoon on Isabel and steers a course due north, magnetic, at the end of 150 miles, he will lift the pounded coral beaches of Lord Howe above the sea. Lord Howe is a ring of land some 150 miles in circumference, several hundred yards wide at its widest, and towering in places to a height of 10 feet above sea level. Inside this ring of sand is a mighty lagoon studded with coral patches. Lord Howe belongs to the Solomons neither geographically nor ethnically. It is an atoll, while the Solomons are high islands, and its people and language are Polynesian, while the inhabitants of the Solomons are Melanesian. Lord Howe has been populated by the westward Polynesian drift, which continues to this day, big outrigger canoes being washed upon its beaches by the southeast trade, that there has been a slight Melanesian drift in the period of the northwest monsoon is also evident. Nobody ever comes to Lord Howe, or Ontung Java, as it is sometimes called. Thomas Cook and Son do not sell tickets to it, and tourists do not dream of its existence. Nor even a white missionary has landed on its shore. Its 5,000 natives are as peaceable as they are primitive. Yet, they are not always peaceable. The sailing directions speak of them as hostile and treacherous. But the men who compile the sailing directions have never heard of the change that was worked in the hearts of the inhabitants, who, not many years ago, cut off a big bark and killed all hands with the exception of the second mate. This survivor carried the news to his brothers. The captains of 3 trading schooners returned with him to Lord Howe. They sailed their vessels right into the lagoon and proceeded to preach the white man's gospel that only white men shall kill white men, and that the lesser breeds must keep hands off. The schooners sailed up and down the lagoon, harrying and destroying. There was no escape from the narrow sand circle, no bush to which to flee. The men were shot down at sight, and there was no avoiding being sighted. The villages were burned, the canoes smashed, chickens and pigs killed, and the precious coconut trees chopped down. For a month, this continued, and the schooners sailed away, but the fear of the white man had been seared into the souls of the islanders, and never again were they rash enough to harm one. Max Bunster was the one white man on Lord Howe, trading in the pay of the ubiquitous Moongleam Soap Company. And the company billeted him on Lord Howe because, next to getting rid of him, it was the most out-of-the-way place to be found. That the company did not get rid of him was due to the difficulty of finding another man to take his place. He was a strapping big German. There's something wrong in his brain. Semi-madness would be a charitable statement of his condition. He was a bully and a coward, and a thrice bigger savage than any savage on the island. Being a coward, his brutality was of the cowardly order. When he first went into the company's employ, he was stationed on Savo. When a consumptive colonist was sent to take his place, he beat him up with his fists and sent him off a wreck in the schooner that brought him. Mr. Have-Be next selected a young Yorkshire giant to relieve Bunster. The Yorkshire man had a reputation as a bruiser and preferred fighting to eating. but Munster wouldn't fight. He was a regular little lamb. For 10 days, at the end of which time the Yorkshire man was prostrated by a combined attack of dysentery and fever. Then Munster went for him, among other things, getting him down and jumping on him a score or so of times. Afraid of what would have happened when his victim recovered, Munster fled away in a cutter to Gavutu, where he signaled himself by beating up a young Englishman already crippled by a boar bullet through both hips. Then it was that Mr. Haveby sent Munster to Lord Howe, the falling-off place. He celebrated his landing by mopping up half a case of gin and by thrashing the elderly and wheezy mate of the schooner which had brought him. When the schooner departed, he called the Kanakas down to the beach and challenged them to throw him in a wrestling bout, promising a case of tobacco to the one who succeeded. 3 Kanakas he threw, but was promptly thrown by a fourth, who, instead of receiving the tobacco, got a bullet through his lungs. And so began Bunster's reign on Lord Howe. 3,000 people lived in the principal village, but it was deserted, even in broad day, when he passed through. Men, women, and children fled before him. Even the dogs and pigs got out of the way, while the king was not above hiding under a mat. The 2 prime ministers lived in terror of Munster, who never discussed any moot subject, but struck out with his fists instead. And to Lord Howe came Maquis, to toil for Munster for 8 long years and a half. There was no escaping from Lord Howe. For better or for worse, Munster and he were tied together. Munster weighed 200 pounds. Maquis weighed 110. Munster was a degenerate brute. But Maquis was a primitive savage. But both had wills and ways of their own. Maquis had no idea of the sort of master he was to work for. He had had no warnings, and he had concluded, as a matter of course, that Munster would be, like other white men, a drinker of much whiskey, a ruler and a lawgiver who always kept his word and who never struck a boy undeserved. Munster had the advantage. He knew all about Maquis and gloated over the coming into possession of him. The last cook was suffering from a broken arm and a dislocated shoulder, so Munster made Maquis cook and general houseboy. We're reading this evening Maquis, a short story by Jack London that was first published in Hampton's magazine in about 1908. We'll be back after this.
Time. Houston. You're tuned to KBOO Portland, Gremlin Time, the bedtime story program for grown-ups.
Welcome back to Gremlin Time. This is Fortunato. This evening, we're reading a story from Jack London's Tales of Cannibals and Headhunters, edited by Gary Rydell and Thomas Titzer, published by University of New Mexico Press of Albuquerque. Let's return now to Maquis by Jack London. And Maquis soon learned that there were white men and white men. On the very day the schooner departed, he was ordered to buy a chicken from Samasi, a native Tongan missionary. But Samasi had sailed across the lagoon and would not be back for 3 days. Maquis returned with the information. He climbed a steep stairway. The house stood on piles 12 feet above the sand, and entered the living room to report. The trader demanded the chicken. Maquis opened his mouth to explain the missionary's absence, but Bunster did not care for explanations. He struck out with his fist. The blow caught Maquis on the mouth and lifted him in the air. Clean through the doorway he flew, across the narrow veranda, breaking the top railing and down to the ground. His lips were a construed, shapeless mass, and his mouth was full of blood and broken teeth.
"That'll teach you that black talk. Don't go with me," the trader shouted, purple with rage, peering down at him over the broken railing.
Maquis had never met a white man like this, and he resolved to walk small and never offend. He saw the boat boys knocked about, and one of them put in irons for 3 days with nothing to eat for the crime of breaking a row lock while pulling. Then, too, he heard the gossip of the village and learned why Bunster had taken a third wife by force, as was well known. The first and second wives lay in the graveyard under the white coral sand, with slabs of coral rock at head and feet. They had died, it was said, from beatings he had given them. The third wife was certainly ill-used, as Maquis could see for himself. But there was no way by which to avoid offending the white man, who seemed offended with life. When Maquis kept silent, he was struck and called a sullen brute. When he spoke, he was struck for giving back talk. When he was grave, Bunster accused him of plotting and gave him a thrashing in advance. And when he strove to be cheerful and smile, he was charged with sneering at his lord and master and given a taste of stick. Bunster was a devil. The village would have done for him had it not remembered the lesson of the three schooners. It might have done for him anyway if there had been a bush to which to flee. As it was, the murder of the white man, of any white man, would bring a man of war that would kill the offenders and chop down the precious coconut trees. Then there were the boat boys, with minds fully made up to drown him by accident at the first opportunity to capsize the cutter. Only Bunster saw to it that the boat did not capsize. Maquis was of a different breed, and escape being impossible while Bunster lived, he was resolved to get the white man. The trouble was that he could never find a chance. Bunster was always on guard. Day and night, his revolvers were ready to hand. He permitted nobody to pass behind his back, as Maquis learned after having been knocked down several times. Bunster knew that he had more to fear from the good-natured, even sweet-faced Malete boy than from the entire population of Lord Howe. It gave added zest to the program of torment he was carrying out. And Maquis walked small, accepted his punishments, and waited. All other white men had respected his tambo, but not so Bunster. Maquis' weekly allowance of tobacco was 2 sticks. Bunster passed them to his woman and ordered Maquis to receive them from her hand. But this could not be. Maquis went without his tobacco. In the same way, he was made to miss many a meal and to go hungry many a day. He was ordered to make chowder out of the big clams that grew in the lagoon. This he could not do, for clams were tambo. 6 times in succession, he refused to touch the clams, and 6 times he was knocked senseless. Funster knew that the boy would die first, but called his refusal mutiny, and would have killed him had there been another cook to take his place. One of the traitor's favorite tricks was to catch Maquis' kinky locks and bat his head against the wall. Another trick was to catch Maquis unaware and thrust the live end of a cigar against his flesh. This Bunster called vaccination, and Maquis was vaccinated a number of times a week. Once in a rage, Bunster ripped the cup handle from Maquis's nose, tearing the hole clean out of the cartilage. "Oh, what a mug," was his comment when he surveyed the damage he had wrought. The skin of a shark is like sandpaper, but the skin of a rayfish is like a rasp. In the South Seas, the natives use it as a wood file in smoothing down canoes and paddles. Bunster had a mitten made of a rayfish skin. The first time he tried it on Maquis, with one sweep of the hand, it fetched the skin off his back from neck to armpit. Bunster was delighted. He gave his wife a taste of the mitten and tried it out thoroughly on the boat boys. The prime ministers came in for a stroke each, and they had to grin and take it for a joke. "Laugh, damn you, laugh," was the cue he gave. Maquis came in for the largest share of the mitten. Never a day passed without a caress from it. There were times when the loss of so much cuticle kept him awake at night, and often the half-healed surface was raked raw fresh by the fatuous Mr. Bunster. Maquis continued his patient wait, secure in the knowledge that sooner or later his time would come, and he knew just what he was going to do, down to the smallest detail, when the time did come. One morning, Bunster got up in a mood for knocking seven bells out of the universe. Began on Maquis, and wound up on Maquis. In the interval, knocking down his wife, and hammering all the boat boys. At breakfast, he called the coffee slops, and threw the scalding contents of the cup into Maquis' face. By 10 o'clock, Bunster was shivering with ager, and half an hour later, he was burning with fever. It was no ordinary attack. It quickly became pernicious and developed into blackwater fever. The days passed and he grew weaker and weaker, never leaving his bed. Maquis waited and watched the while his skin grew intact once more. He ordered the boys to beach the cutter, scrub her bottom, and give her a general overhauling. They thought the order emanated from Bunster and they obeyed. But Bunster at the time was lying unconscious and giving no orders. This was Maquis' chance, but still he waited. When the worst was past and Bunster lay convalescent and conscious, but weak as a baby, Maquis packed his few trinkets, including the china cup handle, into his trade box. Then he went over to the village and interviewed the king and his two prime ministers. "This fella Bunster, him good fella you like too much?" he asked. They explained, in one voice, that they liked the traitor not at all. The ministers poured forth a recital of all the indignities and wrongs that had been heaped upon them. The king broke down and wept. Maquis interrupted rudely.
"You savvy me. Me big fella master my country. You no like him, this fella white master. Me no like him. 20 good you put 100 coconut, 200 coconut, 300 coconut along cut him. Him finish. You go sleepin' good fella. Altogether Kanaka sleepin' good fella. By me by big fella noise along house. You no savvy hear him that big fella noise. You altogether sleep strong fella too much."
In like manner, Maquis interviewed the boat boys. Then he ordered Bunster's wife to return to her family house. Had she refused, he would have been in a quandary, for his tambo would not have permitted him to lay hands on her. The house deserted. He entered the sleeping room where the traitor lay in a doze. Maquis first removed the revolvers, then placed the rayfish mitten on his hand. Bunster's first warning was a stroke of the mitten that removed the skin the full length of his nose. "Good fella, eh?" Maquis grinned between two strokes, one of which swept the forehead bare and the other of which cleaned off one side of his face. Laugh, damn you, laugh. Maki did his work thoroughly, and the Kanakas hiding in their houses heard the big fella noise that Bunster made and continued to make for an hour or more. When Maki was done, he carried the boat compass and all the rifles and ammunition down to the cutter, which he proceeded to ballast with cases of tobacco. It was while engaged in this that a hideous skinless thing came out of the house and ran screaming down the beach till it fell in the sand and mowed and gibbered under the scorching sun. Maki looked toward it and hesitated. Then he went over and removed the head, which he wrapped in a mat and stowed in the stern locker of the cutter. So soundly did the Kanakas sleep through that long, hot day that they did not see the cutter run out through the passage and head south. Close hauled on the southeast trade. Nor was the cutter ever sighted on that long tack to the shores of Isabel, and during the tedious head beat from there to Malaita. He landed at Port Adams with a wealth of rifles and tobacco such as no man had ever possessed before. He did not stop there. He had taken a white man's head, and only the bush could shelter him. So back he went to the bush villages, where he shot old Fenfoa and half a dozen of the chief men, and made himself the chief all over the villages. When his father died, Maki's brother ruled in Port Adams, and joined together saltwater men and bushmen. The resulting combination was the strongest of the 10 fighting tribes of Malaita. More than his fears of the British government was Maki's fear of the all-powerful Moon Gleam Soap Company. And one day a message came up to him in the bush, reminding him that he owed the company 8.5 years of labor. He sent back a favorable answer, and then appeared the inevitable white man, the captain of the schooner, the only white man during Maki's reign who ventured the bush and came out alive. This man not only came out, but he brought with him $750 in gold sovereigns, the money price of 8.5 years of labor, plus the cost price of certain rifles and cases of tobacco. Maki no longer weighs 110 pounds. His stomach is 3 times its former girth, and he has 4 wives. He has many other things, rifles and revolvers, hand of a china cup, and an excellent collection of bushmen's heads. But more precious than the entire collection is another head, perfectly dried and cured, with sandy hair and a yellowish beard, which is kept wrapped in the finest of fiber lava lavas. When Maki goes to war with villages beyond his realm, he invariably gets out this head, and alone in his grass palace, contemplates it long and solemnly. At such times, the hush of death falls on the village, and not even a child dare raises a noise. The head is esteemed the most powerful devil on Malaita, and to the possession of it is ascribed all of Maki's greatness. You've been listening to Maki, a short story by Jack London, first published in 1908 in Hampton's Magazine, and comes to us this evening from a book entitled Jack London's Tales of Cannibals and Headhunters, 9 South Sea Stories by America's Master of Adventure, edited and annotated by Gary Rydell and Thomas T. Tetzel, and published by University of New Mexico Press, Albuquerque. In our story, we had music from the classic Kiki Lounge collections of Arthur Lyman and Martin Denny and others. We also had music from the soundtrack of Beyond Rangoon. And we had Miles Davis from the album Bitches Brew, Miles Runs the Voodoo Down. And in our break, we had Joe Strummer, the late, great Joe Strummer from The Clash, from his last album. Rundown Moses was the name of that song. Gremlin Time will be back next month with a special two-part Halloween special. We're going to present one of the great American horror stories, Pigeons from Hell, by Robert E. Howard. We dare you to tune in on the 16th and 23rd of October. And we dare you to listen with the lights out.
Oh, we dare. Yes, we dare. That's a reissue we've been playing. Program from about 3 years ago that we did this Jack London story. Check out that book at the library. Lots of great stories in there, including another one that we did called The Seed of McCoy. This is Gremlin Time. We have a little time before the Tiki Cha-Cha Club. Let's have a little music here. This is the Jazz Crusader.
Stay tuned for the Tiki Cha-Cha Club.
Glad to see you all aboard.
Ole, ole, it's show time.
In the tiki 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 room, in the tiki 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 room,
all the birds sing words and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room,
welcome to our tropical hideaway, you lucky people, you. If we weren't in the show starting right away, we'd be the audience too.
All together in the tiki 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 room, in the tiki 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 room,
all the birds sing words and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room.
Our show is delightful, we hope you'll agree. We hope that it fills you with pleasure and glee. Because if we don't make you feel like that, we're gonna wind up on the lady's hat.
In the tiki 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 room, in the tiki 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 room,
all the birds sing words and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room,
or it's a load up.
In the tiki 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 room, all the birds sing words and the flowers croon. In the tiki 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 room.
Taking you to faraway places and bringing them home to you. This is the Tiki Cha-Cha Club, where the Cocktail Nation meets Exotica at the corner of Kalakaua Boulevard and Bourbon Street in a little Spanish village, a small discotheque on the Isle of Capri.
Of that wacky cha-cha. It's the tacky cha-cha club.
No.
Well, some call it the tweaky cha-cha club, but we're not moving that fast. Or the hippie cha-cha club, as some might call it someday down there. After all, if you've been listening at all, you know darn well that it is in reality or unreality the Tiki Cha-Cha Club. We're taking you to faraway places and bringing them home to you every Monday night right here at KBOO.